Circle, circle, circle. Still not sure what pi means. Radius, diameter, circumference. Where does pi fit in here? I just don't get it.
It's Pi Day, not the dessert, the number. More about why pi is such a big deal. And yeah, we'll explain what it is coming up. First, though, we're joined by Mayor Eric Garcetti, who won re-election last week. Welcome to the program, Mayor, and congratulations.
Thank you, and happy Pi Day, Madeline.
Thank you. All right, well, you said at the outset of your first term that you wanted to get back to basics and not make promises for grand sweeping plans that could not be accomplished. But now that you're beginning your second term, do you have a big goal that you would like to accomplish?
Well, I said back to basics was really about the core things that a city does, which is, you know, improve the economy, build out infrastructure, and try to breathe some faith back into, you know, city government and government in general, where people are so cynical that their calls won't get answers, their concerns won't get met. And, you know, we achieved huge things in the first, 4 years that I've been mayor, cutting the unemployment rate in half, building, I think, more infrastructure, or setting up the building of more infrastructure than any city in America, and trying to get City Hall to be much more responsive. In the second term, though, I told folks, you know, it's great to see an election in which we won, but when Measure H passes, hopefully, and HHH, our two homeless measures, it doesn't mean that there's one less person off the streets or out of a tent tomorrow. I really want to get a war room assembled and count those bodies as we bring them back into housing and turn their lives around. With Measure M, it's a 15 different rail lines that will be expanded or built, but we're still stuck in traffic today. So I think much of it is keeping the same approach. And if I learned anything from the election, I think it was that our approach is resonating, but people still expect us to produce results. But I'd certainly want to see, I think, the most important we face with our city make bold and big strides to get us out of this housing crisis and be a city of opportunity, not just at the top or for everybody in Los Angeles.
Right. Well, let's talk about that, because there was another hard-fought battle over Measure S that you campaigned against, and this would have halted development in the short term for about 2 years. It did bring up a lot of, or at least it revealed a lot of anger at these large developments that are going up in places like Hollywood and in downtown, developments that a lot of people say are just priced out of their range, that these are mainly for high-income earners. So what does that say to you in terms of the ability of this city to create housing for everyone? Why can't more affordable housing be built, and so that people aren't feeling like they're just stretched too thin, most people?
Well, our housing crisis is a couple things. One, it's our wages are too low and our rents are too high. Raising the minimum wage, and we'll see those raises come in the next few years, will be an important part of getting closer to meeting our rents. But also, we have to reduce our rents by simply building more housing. I think that, you know, it's a simple issue of supply and demand. There's too many jobs that want to be in Los Angeles. That's great news. That's why we have unemployment slashed in half. But they have to live somewhere at night. And most cities, not just us, but up and down the West Coast and other places that are having booms, can't build housing fast enough. I think L.A. can. I set a goal of building 100,000 units of housing when I started in 8 years that I hope to be the mayor. And we're more than half of the way there after four. But this year, the biggest initiative legislatively I have is something called a linkage fee that I initiated even long before Measure S was written, to make any builders of market rate or luxury housing, as they do today for schools or parks, have to pay money into a fund that will help us build subsidized, affordable housing for the rest of us. So, you know, most big cities in California have this, in parts of San Diego, San Francisco, Oakland, Sacramento. It's time for Los Angeles to get with it, and I hope the city council will pass the proposal that just passed our city planning commission that would help us get about $100 million a year that we could put into subsidizing affordable housing, and every dollar we put in produces about five in construction. So we're talking a half a billion dollars a year permanently to build more affordable workforce housing. That combined with the land that we'll have through Metro building the 15 rail lines, I also led that 35% of that land housing has to be affordable housing. Those two things combined can keep people where they live, keep our neighborhoods whole, keep the character of our neighborhoods, and break the back of poverty, I believe, in Los Angeles.
Well, let's talk about the linkage fees, because some developers are saying, look, linkage fees, we don't want to pay linkage fees. And if we have to, we'll just go somewhere else. We'll go to other cities that don't have them, maybe, cities nearby. But why should we have to pay linkage fees?
I've heard that argument before, but I don't buy it. And we've worked closely with developers to make it not something. I think there is a fee that would be so high that people would stop building here. But usually what happens is landowners recognize that their land might, you know, be 5% less valuable. They've all seen huge increases in the value of their land lately. So it is something that the market accommodates. But people didn't stop building in San Francisco and Sacramento and San Diego. There is still a huge demand for housing. So I believe that especially as developers ask the city for assistance for, you know, helping us build the infrastructure out, improve the neighborhoods around these buildings, that it's fair for us to ask them to give something back. As I said, we do this today for parks. We do it for schools. We've just missed doing that for affordable housing. And I think the traffic that we're in is a reflection that we don't have enough affordable housing close to our jobs. The air that we breathe, while much cleaner than when I grew up, that's still the dirtiest in America, is a reflection of our housing crisis. Our homelessness is a reflection of our housing crisis. So it really is a prism through which we refract so many of the challenges our city faces. And we have such tremendous momentum in all the other categories of this city. We have to solve this, and I want that to be a big part of our work. And I think a linkage fee will continue to have development happen, but it will be in a more responsible way.
Okay, let's talk about the homeless. You mentioned that as a huge problem, and it sure is. Is there, and creating all this housing, while an admirable goal, will take many, many years. What can you do now in the short term to get people out of these tent encampments? Is there something, you know, outside the box that you're maybe considering, maybe setting aside a place where people could camp and, you know, pitch their tents, or taking some parking lots and devoting them to overnight camping in RVs and cars, things like that?
Well, we are looking at a little bit of that in the latter, but I think the larger, you know, the excitement I have is Measure H. If it holds on, there's still a few votes to count out there, but it looks like it'll just edge over 2/3, which I campaigned very hard for. Mark Ridley Thomas and his colleagues, the Board of Supervisors, put on the county ballot, will give us money for services today. Even before you can get somebody to move a tent, you have to reach out to them. And we had 15 outreach workers in the city of Los Angeles when I started, dealing with a population that's between 25 and 28,000. So I would like to first see the social workers, the mental health professionals, the substance abuse counselors, that army of people get hired up as quickly as we can so that we can begin to have the same people, just like a cop works the same beat over and over, work the same area of town instead of being kind of boomeranged from one neighborhood to the next and never getting to know by name the people who are on the streets. Second, we're looking very creatively. We've worked with some USC and architects at what sort of, you know, prefabricated homes that might be transitional homes we can get people into in the near term while we're building the longer affordable housing. There's a great op-ed piece about that this Sunday in the LA Times, but we're looking at creative, cheaper ways of spending this money up front. It's somewhere between a shelter and a home.
But, you know, sorry, Mayor, to interrupt you. There was an activist who was putting up these tiny homes, and the city tore them down. I mean, that was one outside-the-box immediate solution to,
That was done in a very ad hoc way that I think the council member in that area saw was unhygienic for those folks, was kind of inhumane. There was the possibility of criminal activity, just popping a box, even if it's better constructed, on the same, you know, overpass of a freeway isn't a solution. But building a small village like we are going to be doing now, so the first one of these is moving in the North San Fernando Valley for homeless women, is a quick way to get things constructed where people actually have a bathroom, where they actually have a community, and where they have services. Keeping people in a nicer box, but completely isolated from services and bathrooms, in my mind, I don't think is a solution for any neighborhood or any unhoused Angeleno. So we're trying to do it in thoughtful and creative ways, but also ways we can get moving faster. And then the third thing is we're looking at problem motels and rehabbing those to turn them into transitional housing, because they're already there. Oftentimes the community hates them because there's prostitution or drug dealing going on in them. So we're looking at purchasing a number of them. We have some nonprofits that have already done that with 2 or 3 sites, and putting people in those areas in the short term, getting them services and counseling, and then moving them towards jobs and permanent housing from there.
Okay, let's talk about immigration. Activists have criticized you for not explicitly calling Los Angeles a sanctuary city, instead using the term city of sanctuary. Is there a difference in your mind between those two phrases?
Well, let me be clear. Sanctuary is a term I've embraced from the very start in November when I talked to kids at Roosevelt High School who were worried about going to school. And if sanctuary city means that our police officers won't enforce immigration law, then we are, and proudly so. But I always want to make sure, because I think a lot of people hear the term, and it's been defined certainly by enemies of immigration and immigration reform as a term that defines that we give sanctuary to dangerous, violent criminals, that we don't, and that is not Los Angeles. So I absolutely have said that Los Angeles, under my watch, will not have Los Angeles Police Department officers enforcing immigration law, but we'll go further than that. We're not just a city of a sanctuary. We're a city that is going to provide legal defense to those targeted populations who are faced with deportation, from our dreamers to, you know, unaccompanied minors and others. And we're putting our money where our mouth is. I think Los Angeles has led this country. No city is doing more to make sure we not only join the cases against the executive orders, provide legal counsel to individuals facing deportation, speak out against ICE using the term police, deal with individual cases like the father who was taken from his children while dropping them off at school, and going out to the airport and making sure our refugees and asylum seekers are welcomed as well.
So LA is a sanctuary city? Is LA a sanctuary city?
If the definition that you are using today, and that's why I always kind of poke at the administration a little bit, because they say we're taking your money away, but they won't define what they mean by sanctuary city, if it's that we will not deputize our law enforcement officers to enforce immigration law, then yes, we are.
And well, right, because it's against the law to do that. But
no, it's not. There's many cities that do. And this is a difference. Los Angeles does not. You can. And there's, in Oklahoma, you have police departments that volunteer to be cross-deputized and then suddenly become the enforcers of federal immigration law. We know how dangerous that is in Los Angeles, how unsafe that is, and how it erodes decades of trust we've built with our immigrant communities. And we will never do that on my watch.
Although when people are arrested, isn't their information shared with ICE?
Not from
once
the city of Los Angeles.
Arrested?
The county of Los Angeles and the jails do. But we have honored zero of the detainer requests the last 2 years running, even before President Trump was elected, that ICE has given us, because they said that they would be for serious or violent felonies. And many times they weren't. It was the grandmother who maybe had a felony because she hadn't paid her parking tickets, or somebody who had already served time, paid his or her debt to society, but they wanted to deport them based on past criminal records. So we have honored exactly zero of that in the city of L.A., but the county of L.A., you're correct, is a place we still need to continue to work to make sure that we keep those lanes separate, and that feds are responsible for immigration law, but local law enforcement is focused on keeping our local streets safe.
All right. So when will you make a definitive statement about whether or not you will run for governor in 2018?
I am so excited to be mayor. I tell you, my wife and I, the day after the election, were like so excited to get back to work and to spend a little time with my daughter. I don't make those promises, but I can tell everybody listening I am focused only on being mayor, and I'm excited to be mayor in a second term.
Okay, so you're not making that definitive statement yet.
I never do. And the reason why is, you know, I think it's a disservice to people who you serve, who may ask you to serve their city in different roles. But that's not a coy way of saying I'm running for governor. I'm excited to be sworn in as mayor for a second term.
And you'll carry out the entire term?
Nope, I don't make that pledge ever.
Okay, all right. So that was not definitive. I think
it was honest and straightforward. What I say is, you know, you look at President Obama, if he had said, I will serve out every last moment of being state senator in Chicago, he couldn't have served the people of Chicago as well. So it's a disservice to those folks. I don't make that promise, but I do say that I absolutely am focused on being mayor.
Okay, so you're leaving the door open is what it sounds like.
Correct.
Mayor Eric Garcetti, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we want to hear from you. What issues would you like to see the mayor prioritize and why? You can call us 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or weigh in on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Well, the mayor talked about creating more affordable housing. It's hard to do that when, at the same time, the city is losing more rent-controlled apartments than ever before. Landlords are using a state law called the Ellis Act to take rent-controlled apartments off the market. Last year, nearly 1,400 units were removed, about 27% more than the year before. And here to tell us more about that is Gary Painter. He's a professor of public policy at USC. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Okay, 1,400 units. This is in a city where I believe there are around 570,000 apartments. So 1,400 doesn't sound like a lot, but what does that say to you?
No, it doesn't sound like a lot, but the needs for affordable housing just keep increasing as we keep observing rents going up faster than household incomes. And so when we're talking about those who are most at the margins of housing insecurity, taking even 100 units offline, you know, is going to put some families at risk during that period unless they get replaced in one way or another.
Tell us about the Ellis Act. It's been around since 1985. It was named after Republican State Senator Jim Ellis. What is it? What does it say exactly?
Well, just in kind of broad terms, it allows landlords, if they want to get out of the rental business, to not be forced to stay in the rental business if their property is currently providing rent-controlled units. And so the question then becomes, how do you allow for provisions to go out of the rental business? And so you could sell a property, you could demolish the property. There's lots of things that you can do. And then various cities then have the option to make sure that, for instance, in Los Angeles, as I understand it, you can't kind of demolish, rebuild a multifamily building, and then kind of say, well, now I'm in the market rate business only 2 years later, that there's provisions in there that says if you are then taking a property at that location, it has to be over 5 years kind of to rejoin the rental business. Otherwise, you're going to be subject to the rent control provisions.
But once you have a building emptied, you can charge market rate, even if it is under rent control, right? In other words, if you kick someone out and someone else comes in and rents the apartment, they rent it at whatever rate you set, and then it's subject to rent control every year after that, right?
The thing about it is that the cities have the ability to control some of those transitions. So you can't just declare Ellis Act, evict everyone, and then say, okay, now we're back in business at a new rate. So they do have the provision in place so that, you know, it is reviewed by the appropriate agency.
So if you wanted to, if you had a building and it was all apartments under rent control and you wanted to, let's say, condoize it, could you do that?
You can do that under certain provisions. That's correct. So you can sell it, you can sell off each individual unit. And so that's one of the ways that, you know, there's kind of two most common ways. One is that people just sell the building and then that new owner has to decide what they're going to do with it. And maybe they'll wait out 5 years, maybe they'll do other things. But the second kind of way that an owner of a building gets out of the business is to sell off the individual units.
Right. And so a developer couldn't just remodel an existing building, call the units condos, put it back on the market immediately?
The exact time frame, I'll have to admit, I don't know how quickly that can happen, but the Ellis Act does allow for, you know, a developer to buy the building, a year later remodel it, and then to sell those as individual condos.
So do you think the Ellis Act should be gotten rid of? Is it too detrimental, or does it not have that big of an effect? What do you think?
Well, I think that it's hard to look at any kind of affordable housing set of issues with one particular law or one particular program. I think absolutely the city has to make sure that it is playing its role to make sure that it is avoiding negative incentives for landlords just to simply, you know, sell, get out of it, and then lose those units altogether. The city has to think broadly about what it can do to preserve affordable housing. And one way that it could do that is to lengthen the provision from which that a particular building could be rented out without rent control. The other thing it could do is it could establish certain provisions about, you know, what that building can become and how quickly it can become. However, 1,400 units in this time when rents are going up faster than incomes, you know, that's still a significant chunk of our affordable housing units that are available to Angelenos.
Gary Painter, public policy professor at USC, thanks.
All right, thank you.
And we want to hear from you. Have you been evicted from your apartment under the Ellis Act? What was your experience like finding a new place to live in Los Angeles? Let us know on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how everyone in Washington is now looking over their shoulder and wondering if they are living in a city of spies. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Washington, D.C. is a city prone to mood swings, depending on the party and the people in power. And one word that describes its current mood right now could be paranoia. With the Trump administration's ties to Russia under scrutiny, some people are reexamining their own encounters with foreign diplomats that may have seemed friendly at first, drinks that may have seemed casual, but in hindsight, we're anything but. The Atlantic's Molly Ball wrote a piece this week called City of Spies, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Great to be here.
Great to have you. So for those of us who don't live in Washington, give us a sense of what these kinds of casual interactions are like for, let's say, government officials. You know, they meet someone in a bar, a diplomat, an ambassador. Are they now thinking, maybe that there was something more to that?
Well, you just never know in this town. I think there's a lot of spycraft that goes on under the surface of Washington, D.C. And if you're in the national security community, you sort of go, well, duh, this is the capital of the world's superpower. Of course that's the case. But if you are sort of innocent of that world, or if you're just a regular D.C. commuter, it's kind of mind-blowing to realize that there's all of this secret jockeying going on by foreign powers all around you. You have the Russia investigation now turning into this game of sort of connect the dots with the Russian ambassador, who some have reported our intelligence community believes to be a Russian spy. But if you go to cocktail parties or think tanks, he's alleged to have met Trump, or he did meet Trump, at a reception line at a speech at a think tank, which is something that D.C. people go to all the time, and you meet all kinds of people.
Yeah,
you go to Christmas parties in D.C. and maybe you met the Russian ambassador. So was that just mingling, or was it something else?
Because he or others might be pumping people for information, or just overhearing gossip, or what is it that they're looking for?
Well, I spoke to a former diplomat from a former ambassador to the U.S. from Hungary, who said, don't ever accept an invitation to the Russian embassy unless you know what you're doing, because the Russians are notorious for their ability to do this sort of human intelligence. I am certainly not alleging that every conversation with the Russian ambassador is necessarily some kind of intelligence operation. But we certainly know from the whole Michael Flynn episode that every single one of his phone calls is taped and transcribed by U.S. intelligence. So maybe don't get on the phone with him.
So this is Sergei Kislyak, and it's remarkable how under the radar he has flown, even though he has been the Russian ambassador for a very long time, right? A couple of decades?
He is sort of described in conflicting terms in a lot of the profiles of him that have been published in recent days as people try to understand his role. On the one hand, he is described as someone who's sort of under the radar and isn't known to a lot of people, isn't a big schmoozer. On the other hand, he is someone who has been pretty aggressive, apparently, about pursuing relationships with people, as ambassadors are, of course, supposed to do, making contact with senators and candidates and so on, which all ambassadors try to do. And apparently he's got a reputation for sort of aggressively arguing Russia's positions in these contexts.
Well, also, it's been reported that some journalists may be targets of Russian hacking.
That's right. Many of my colleagues have been receiving alerts from Google that there's some state actors attempting to break into their email, which is kind of alarming. And as I detail in the piece, their congressional staffers have to sort of perpetually be on alert for attempts to overhear their conversations. There are supposedly Chinese spies who hang out at a bar on Capitol Hill trying to listen in on what junior staffers are gossiping about. You just never know what's really going on.
Right. So it's not just Russia. That's, as you say, it's China. It could be other nations. You say that the ambassador of the United Arab Emirates, he throws these hot parties that everyone wants to attend. And, well, you know, the UAE might be interested in some information as well.
That's right. The Huffington Post did a wonderful investigation on the UAE ambassador, Yosef Al-Otaiba, last year, where they detailed all of these instances in which he may have actually influenced the American policy in the Middle East because he's so aggressively made this network of connections by spending a lot of money, throwing a lot of parties, and making a lot of friends throughout the American government.
And he threw a 50th birthday party for Joe Scarborough?
He threw a 50th birthday party for Joe Scarborough. He threw an after party this year to the alfalfa dinner at Cafe Milano, where multiple cabinet secretaries and senators and Jeff Bezos, the Amazon CEO and owner of the Washington Post, were all in attendance. And it's impossible to tell where the schmoozing ends and the not necessarily spycraft, but the information gathering begins.
But has it always been thus in Washington that there have been these glittery parties with people looking for access and influence and looking to curry favor or burnish their reputation in some way with other people in power? Isn't that just the way the city works?
Absolutely. And, you know, going back to the Cold War, certainly there have been Russian espionage operations or Soviet, I suppose, in that case. Mm-hmm. The U.S. law that requires lobbyists for foreign governments or anyone trying to influence American public opinion on behalf of a foreign government to register, that dates back to before World War II, when there were a lot of concerns about covert German propaganda in the United States. So yes, this has always been the case. It's just that recent events have sort of heightened people's alarm about it.
Okay, given the fact that you might have representatives of foreign governments trying to get information from young staffers by overhearing their conversations in bars or what have you, are these staffers being trained to not talk about certain things in public?
That was actually an amazing thing that I learned in reporting this piece. There is virtually no security training for members of congressional staffs. If you get a security clearance and have access to classified documents, then you are trained about the sensitivity of this information and how to handle it. But there's a lot of valuable information that is accessible to congressional staff who don't have security clearances. And besides being told, don't take your phone if you go on a foreign junket, they really don't get a lot of explanation of this at all. And I think, you know, a lot of them have come in by being congressional interns at a very young age or by working on a local campaign in whatever state that they're from, and may be pretty vulnerable to the kinds of things that spies are good at doing.
Molly Ball writes about politics for The Atlantic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a novel that is relevant now about a pair of refugees on the run.
I wanted to write a novel about the migration apocalypse to discover if in it, maybe we could find something that was actually hopeful and not apocalyptic.
Mohsen Hamid is here to talk about his new book, Exit West. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. President Donald Trump issued a new travel ban last week. It bars all refugees from entering the United States for 120 days. No new visas would be granted to people from 6 Muslim-majority countries. The ban has a lot of people thinking about the plight of migrants and refugees, people like Mohsen Hamid. The best-selling author is out with a new novel. It's called Exit West, and it begins in an unnamed city that is, as he writes, swollen by refugees, but still mostly at peace, or at least not yet openly at war. When war does break out, a young couple flees their home, and through mysterious doors, they arrive in Greece, then London, then California, and they attempt to make new lives for themselves. In the process, they find their relationship changes, their identities questioned by themselves and others. And Mohsen Hamid joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, this takes place in the near future?
Yeah, it's a half heartbeat ahead of today, maybe tomorrow or next month or next year.
And you came up with this idea of magical doors, I suppose. I suppose they're magical. How did you come up with that?
In the novel, what happens is, of course, that these characters pass through these doors and they're opening all over the world. I began with the idea or a feeling, I guess, that the doors already exist. I was Skyping with someone, I think, or doing a video call on my computer, and it struck me just how much it actually was like looking through a window.
Hmm.
And I got to thinking about on my phone how I surf the internet and I can go from California to Egypt to Antarctica. And right now I'm in America. I got on a plane and went from Pakistan to London and then to the US. So I think the emotional reality of technology today is like a world where doors let us transport our consciousness and our bodies. So the doors came from that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you talk a lot about the internet as a tool for connection, at least in the beginning, but also as a tool for surveillance. And at the beginning of their relationship, this couple, Saeed and Nadia, they fall in love, but they fall in love in large part through texting or through the internet.
They're sending messages to each other. It's
yeah.
interesting. In a place like Pakistan, for example, and say the Nadia city is not named, but it's quite a bit like Lahore, Pakistan, where I live, at least when it's still at peace. It can be difficult for young people to get together, to meet up. So a lot of romance does happen online, in internet cafes and on WhatsApp and Facebook. And that's how, say, the Nadia's romance initially takes wing.
But it's interesting how she wants to be very physical with him and have sex with him, and he doesn't.
Yeah, say the Nadia are two people with somewhat different outlooks on life. Say this, in some senses, more conservative. He's a man who has a strong spiritual feeling. He's very close to his family. He's a little bit traditional in some senses. He's also romantic, and he believes that he should have sex with somebody who's his wife. Nadia is not particularly traditional. She's not much in the way of religious. She's resolutely forward-looking and sort of wants to do what she wants to do. And navigating that difference between them is part of the tension, and initially at least part of their attraction.
I love that she rides a motorcycle, but she wears a burqa.
The idea for Nadia's appearance, or the fact that she wears this black robe that covers most of her, came from many things. But one of the characters that brought it to my mind was an actress in Pakistan who's a friend of my wife's and has now become a famous TV actress. She's recognized wherever she goes. So she puts on this covering and then goes to the market or drives her car, and she passes completely unnoticed. That idea of covering making you able to pass, to go places you otherwise couldn't go, struck me as very interesting.
Yeah, because a lot of people here in the West, at least, they see the robe, the black robes, as something that impinges on a woman's freedom. But you're using it for the reverse, that she, Nadia, can do whatever she wants if she's wearing the black robe.
Yeah, I think Nadia would say that the way that people look at her, and particularly men look at her, impinges on her freedom. That she lives in a place where women are not supposed to live alone, away from their families if they're unmarried. And yet she wants to do these things. And so the robe protects her from being shaped by how people see her. And in that sense, yes, it opens up spaces otherwise that she would otherwise be unable to go into.
Now you say Saeed is more conservative. He's also more religious than she. And that's a little bit of a sets up some tension between the two of them. And I was just wondering, as the book progresses, he gets more religious, or as he's more attracted to prayer, if you could read this passage, it's towards the end of the book, where he is talking about praying more often.
Now, though, in Marin, Saeed prayed even more, several times a day. And he prayed fundamentally as a gesture of love for what had gone and would go and could be loved in no other way. When he prayed, he touched his parents, who could not otherwise be touched, and he touched a feeling that we are all children who lose our parents, all of us, every man and woman and boy and girl, and we too will all be lost by those who come after us and love us. And this loss unites humanity, unites every human being, the temporary nature of our beingness and our shared sorrow, the heartache we each carry and yet too often refuse to acknowledge in one another. And out of this, Saeed felt it might be possible, in the face of death, to believe in humanity's potential for building a better world. And so he prayed as a lament, as a consolation, and as a hope.
That is so beautiful. And he couldn't express that to Nadia.
He has great difficulty doing that. In many ways, their romance is the romance between two strands of human outlook that we tend to think are opposed. You know, people who do find meaning through religious faith and people who don't. And I've tend to think that neither of those two strands will ever win. It's not that one day everybody will be religious or everybody will be not religious. The idea that these two things have to be in conflict and have to fight to the bitter end until one emerges victorious, I think, is mistaken. What's more interesting, instead of looking at the conflict between them, is you know, to what extent can they find a friendship or even an attraction, even a romance?
But in that passage, he's talking about connection. And he's talking about how prayer connects him to the rest of the world. And yet it's such a private thought. And he feels like he can't really share it with the person he's closest to.
Yes. In Said's case, he has this struggle because so much of the religion around him is politicized religion. It's religion that says, you know, you belong to this group or that group. It's where you identify yourself by your religion and then separate yourself by virtue of religion. But his religion is something quite different. His religion is a very personal way of navigating the fact that he's had to leave his parents, he's lost his parents, he's lost the place he grew up in, he's in a new place. And like people have done since the beginning of human history, the transience of life is more bearable for him with his own personal religious feeling. And he does want to share that. The problem for him, of course, is that it doesn't seem Nadia thinks at all in the same way, and he's unable to articulate how he feels. And it's unclear whether if he were to articulate this, maybe he would spark some sort of understanding within her. And maybe he resents that partly, that she doesn't feel that way. Or maybe she resents that he does. But for whatever reason, they're unable to fully connect on this issue.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Mohsen Hamid about his new book, Exit West. Now, I understand you began writing this book a long time before the current refugee crisis, either here or in Europe. So what was on your mind when you began writing this novel?
I'd already begun to feel that there was a backlash against migrants, against people who move from one place to another, and it was getting stronger and stronger. And I'd lived in London and before that in New York, and that sense of backlash against migrants was growing. And when I moved back to Pakistan about 7 years ago, I discovered that so many people wanted to leave. And so the notion that there were people who wanted to migrate, and the numbers seemed to be enormous, and people who didn't want migrants to come, set in my mind this notion of a kind of clash. And I wanted to explore a future where we could imagine optimistically going forward despite that clash. So in a way, I wanted to write a novel about the migration apocalypse to discover if in it, maybe we could find something that was actually hopeful and not apocalyptic.
And do you think you did?
I think, hopefully, yes. One of the great dangers we have today is that if you talk about the future, so many people find it difficult to articulate what they'd like to see. And so they're drawn to nostalgic visions of America in the 1950s or Britain before it joined the EU or Islam in the time of the caliphate. These sorts of nostalgic visions are very potent if you can't imagine the future, and they're dominant at this moment in time in some places. In the novel, though, what I guess I'm trying to look at is what happens after people get mixed. What happens after all these different things get mashed together? Usually what happens is a period of extreme fertility where new things are born. America is an example of that. America is the product of all sorts of people coming over centuries and mixing together. And so it's a bit strange in a way that this mixing should be thought of as un-American. I think in some ways it's entirely American.
Although the circumstances that Nadia and Said find themselves in, they're not exactly, I don't know, it doesn't seem like they're living very comfortably. It seems like they're living on a razor's edge and they have to pick up and move, you know, all the time. And they end up living in these big refugee camps, in shanty in one instance. It doesn't seem like a particularly comfortable existence.
No, and it isn't. And I don't think it's likely to be. The novel looks at the next 2 or 3 years of migration as though, 2 or 3 centuries of migration as though they could happen in just 1 or 2 years. And I think in the next centuries, as sea levels rise and climates change, billions of people are going to move. And it won't be easy. In fact, it'll be incredibly difficult and very painful. And we can make it much more painful by stoking sort of hatred and fear of each other. But at the same time, people will find a way. They always have. They come together, they mix, new things are born, new ways of thinking are born, new kinds of art and music and food and culture come into creation. And we find a way. And I think it's important to begin to imagine, not that things will be easy, but that our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren will find ways to be happy and to pursue what it is that they find interesting. But those ways will just be very different from the ways that we do.
I love the line that you have. It's towards the end of the book where you say, we are all migrants through time.
Yes. Imagine somebody in Los Angeles who was born there 80 years ago and has never left LA, has lived there their entire lives. And when that person steps outside of their house today, they find a city that's transformed. The school where they went to school has been paved over. It's become a parking lot. The playground has become an office building. Their friends have dispersed or passed away. People from different places have moved. The language, the architecture, the accents they hear, all that's changed. That person hasn't migrated geographically, but the city around them feels almost like a different country from the one that they were born into. So they have migrated. To be human and live a life is to migrate through time.
And so it's just our reaction to it that we can control.
Well, the issue is that we have culturally had lots of ways to accept transience, to say that, look, human lives are brief and transient, and we can still find enormous beauty and meaning in that brevity and transience. But at this moment, so many of the ways that we used to be able to comfort ourselves and deal with that transience are being taken away. Family structures are getting weaker. The sense that we belong to a particular nation or ethnicity or tribe is getting weaker. Religions are being politicized. Folk stories are disappearing. And so we're losing many of the ways that we used to become comfortable with transience. And I think we need to invent new ways. And part of that, of course, is what fiction and art and storytelling does, is to invent new ways of dealing with things like this.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Mohsen Hamid. He's the author of the new book. It's called Exit West. And Mohsen Hamid will be in conversation with another great writer, Hector Tobar, tomorrow night at the Skirball. It's free, and it begins at 8 o'clock. Coming up, Happy Pi Day. Not the food, the number. How the formula for a circle became a thing. Next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
I can recite pi to 40,000 places. The last digit is one.
Pi.
Simpsons talking about pi. Pi, the number, is just a little bit less famous than pi, the dessert, but references to the irrational number are everywhere, from music. To movies.
Max Cohen is searching for order in a world of chaos.
Okay, 322 times 491.
158,102.
Right. Pi, a film by Darren Aronofsky.
It's just a number.
And today is March 14th, 314 Pi Day, which is basically a nationally sanctioned excuse to eat pie and make math jokes. Here to tell us more is Anna Hensch, assistant professor of mathematics at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. Hi.
Hello.
All right. What is pi exactly?
Well, pi is an irrational number, which means it's an infinite decimal. So you have 3.14159 and so on. So it's an infinitely long number.
How far can you go?
Oh, as far as I just said, 3.14159. I'm not very impressive on that front.
Okay, so it is actually infinite?
It's actually infinite. But the way that most people learn about pi is as the circumference of a circle divided by the diameter. That's probably the first time you ever see pi, and this is going to come up in some, maybe in your middle school first geometry course or something.
And so no matter how big the circle is, you'll always get 3.14?
No matter how big it is.
Is that why it's called an irrational number?
Well, it's called an irrational number because it's infinite.
Uh-huh.
But this fact that every circle gives you the same number if you take the circumference and divide it by the diameter, that's a little bit crazy.
It is. It is a little crazy. A little irrational.
I would have loved to have been the guy who first discovered that.
Who was the guy who first discovered it?
By the way, it was Archimedes was the first person to really do these calculations. And he did it in a really crazy way, actually, by taking, well, if you imagine drawing a circle and drawing its diameter, the diameter is pretty easy to measure. That's just the line across the middle.
Yeah.
It's straight. But a circle is really hard to measure because it's circular. You can't even get like a measuring tape to lay down in a perfect circle. So what he did was he drew boxes. First he drew a square around the circle, and he thought, okay, that's going to be a little bit bigger than the circle, and squares are easy to measure.
Mm-hmm.
And he drew a square inside the circle, and he said, okay, that's another square that's easy to measure. So the circumference has to be a little bit smaller than the outside square and a little bit bigger than the inside square.
So not precise.
Not precise. And he did the same method. Instead of using a square, he used a pentagon, so a five-sided thing,
oh.
And a hexagon and a heptagon. And he did this by hand, if you can imagine, up to a 96-sided polygon, calculating the circumference of a 96-sided polygon. And with that, he was able to approximate pi up to some high number of digits. But this was all done by hand, which is pretty wild. Now we can do it. You know, we can compute up to whatever, 70,000 digits without even breaking a sweat.
And because he's Greek, that's why it's called pi?
I suppose so, yeah.
Because pi is the Greek letter for p?
Pi is the Greek letter.
Yeah. Which I guess means perimeter, right? Or p for perimeter?
P for perimeter, right. Yeah. That
okay. So aside from interesting, you know, tricks in drawing and that kind of thing, what is pi used for?
So pi is... It sits at this really interesting intersection of actually a lot of fields of math. So I think the most applicable place you'll see it is in a lot of physics. So in physics, you do a lot of studying of cyclic things or wave-like things. Imagine you can measure waves, like waves in the ocean or sound waves as they travel through space. And they all have this nice cyclic undulating pattern. And all of those can be modeled by something called Fourier series. And the important thing here is that those Fourier series always have pi showing up in them. So this number pi has some special tricks that allow you to encode undulating or cyclic behavior. So without the number pi, physics would be impossible.
Wow. You just blew my mind.
So glad.
Okay.
It shows up in other places also, like in number theory. For example, did you know that if you summed up 1 over every square, so like 1 plus 1 over 4 plus 1 over 9 plus 1 over 16 up to infinity, you get pi squared over 6.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm. little known fact.
So a little known fact I just discovered is it's also Albert Einstein's birthday today.
Oh, how about that?
Is that a math conspiracy or what?
Maybe we should be celebrating that instead. But his name doesn't have anything to do with baked goods.
I know, exactly. He needs to change his name. Do you think that's why we're obsessed with it? Why do we celebrate pi every 3, 1, 4?
I think it's because of the pi.
Really?
because there are so many interesting irrational numbers. Think about the golden ratio phi, which is about 1.618. The golden ratio is so interesting, and there's a wealth of stuff you can say about that as well. Or something really easy like the square root of 5, the square root of 2. You know, these are all irrational numbers that are just contain a wealth of information. But I think since they don't have pie or cake associated to them, they're not as fun to celebrate. So I think that pie just it's a situation of very good marketing.
Who is behind this? Who is the evil genius?
Maybe it was Archimedes. Maybe it's a really, really long game kind of marketing campaign.
Well, you know, there's also the issue that there's no pattern to the repetition, right, in the numbers that go beyond the decimal point.
Right. So it's infinite and random. And that makes it, I think, extra tantalizing that, you know, you can think, oh, whatever, I can conceptualize the infinitude of something. I can conceptualize infinity and randomness. But pi is a way to actually get your hands on it, that you can kind of march along these numbers, and they're completely random, and they go on forever. And you don't know what you're going to find if you keep marching out.
So on a scale of 1 to infinity, how excited are you in the mathematics department today about Pi Day?
I'm like an infinity excited because we had pizza today for Pi Day. So that it took me all the way there.
All right. Anna Hensch teaches mathematics at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. And happy Pi Day.
You too. And happy Pi Day to you. I'm Madeline Brand. I hope your day is filled with pie. I'll see you tomorrow.